Well, hi there. My name is Richard Serrett. Welcome once again to Coast AM, and welcome to the night. I happen to love the dark because that's when we can see the stars. Thanks for inviting me into your home once again. I guess I didn't get it quite right last night, so they've brought me back again this evening, and we'll try and set things straight. Here we go. I brought my thermos of coffee with me, and I just grabbed a coffee mug from the kitchen here at Talk Radio AM 640. That's Coast's Toronto affiliate. Just grabbed a random mug and out of the dishwasher. Looking at it right now, and I see it's inscribed with a quote from Oscar Wilde. It says, "Work is the curse of the drinking class." And gosh darn, all I have to put in it is coffee. Well, I'll raise a cup to you anyway. Thanks for hanging out with me. Before we get to tonight's menu, a couple of things. I want to keep you up to date on Malaysia Airline Flight 17 as best I can. If you haven't heard, rebels have recovered the black boxes and will hand them over to the International Civil Aviation Organization. A rebel spokesman said the bodies recovered from the crash site in eastern Ukraine will remain in refrigerated train cars at a station in the rebel-held town of Torres, 15 kilometers or about 9 miles away, until the arrival of an international aviation delegation. Ukraine and the separatists are accusing each other, of course, of firing a surface-to-air missile Thursday at Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 as it flew from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur, some 33,000 feet above the battlefields of eastern Ukraine. Both deny shooting down the plane, although those on board the flight, 283 passengers and 15 crew, were killed. Immediately, not clear if the rebels and the Ukrainian government are working together or whether they're at odds with each other on recovering the bodies. But from their comments, many of the officials didn't appear to know either. Meanwhile, as I say, everyone's pointing fingers at everyone else. The Ukrainian government is pointing fingers at the Russian rebels, the Russian rebels in Moscow are pointing fingers at Ukrainian officials, the White House, Secretary of State John Kerry, pointing fingers at Russia. Russia TV, a Russian-sponsored English-speaking TV station in the U.S., has kind of backed away from insinuating that the real target of the missile attack that brought down MH17 was Russian President Vladimir Putin's plane that was supposedly in the area at around that time. John McCain, Hillary Clinton have been very vocal in blaming the Russian separatists. The thing is, I don't understand. The plane is flying at around 33,000 feet, which would, to me, suggest quite sophisticated high-tech weaponry would be in use. And I can't help thinking that might be beyond the capabilities of the insurgents. I mean, they're relying primarily, from what I understand, on shoulder-mounted rocket launchers. However, there's evidence to suggest that they did commandeer some more sophisticated surface-to-air missiles, something called a Buck missile battery, or a BUK. There remains doubts, however, as to whether these insurgents would have the necessary radar equipment and whether they have the 15-man specialist crews, which are apparently required to man the Buck missile battery. There's very little concrete evidence at this time that would allow any side to come to definitive conclusions. And the black boxes and recording devices will no doubt, hopefully, provide answers. But, you know, now that the Russian insurgents have supposedly secured them, there's going to be a great dispute as to, can we trust the findings? There needs to be a forensic, unbiased investigation, obviously. Here's what concerns me, and that's this tragedy could mark a pivotal moment in the worst crisis between Russia and the West since the Cold War. We've got 298 people dead, 80 children, because of a stupid game of poker taking place between major powers, and there seems to be nobody with the will or the courage to broker a meaningful ceasefire to pull us all back from the brink. What's happening in eastern Ukraine, Crimea, it's not just a local conflict. These things always seem to boil over. Let's go back 100 years. The assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand and Princess Sophia. That seemed like just a local conflict at one point, and we now know what happened. A local conflict can soon escalate when regional powers get drawn in. Weak leaders with too much power often make stupid choices, and then we all pay the price. As Sir Winston Churchill said, to jaw-jaw is always better than to war-war. That's what worries me. Now I wish I had something a little stronger to put in my coffee mug. With so much pain in the world, war and rumors of war, methinks we could all use a little rejuvenation of our souls and spirit. And I think my guest in hours 2, 3, and 4 can offer just such a salve. Dr. Elena Gabor, a former doctor of dental medicine and now a certified hypnotherapist and past life regression therapist, will join us. She's the author of Home at the Tree of Life, an introduction to subconscious ethereal science. And if this sounds a lot like New Age hokum, it's not. A lot of people are overcoming lifelong addictions, phobias, even unexplained chronic pain by undergoing a past life regression. And it doesn't even matter, apparently, if, like me, you don't believe in reincarnation. It just seems to work. In fact, regression therapy is becoming more and more mainstream. I met Dr. Gabor a few years ago in Santa Monica. I was producing a pilot for a TV program on past life regression therapy. And during the production, I witnessed a pretty remarkable past life regression with the former wife of actor David Carradine, the late David Carradine. In fact, over the years, I've witnessed a number of pretty incredible past life regressions. People going under hypnosis and appearing to relive events, sometimes tragic events, from previous lives. And having knowledge of locations and events from the past. I saw one man suddenly start to speak in an English accent, a pretty convincing one. And I've got a pretty good ear for that sort of thing. So we're going to talk about our past life regression therapy, how it works, why it works, what it might be able to do for you with Dr. Gabor. But we'll also sharpen our pencils and drill down a little deeper into the ethereal science of the soul and discuss the big questions. The hallmark of this program. Who are we? Where do we come from? And what does the universe look like? What's our purpose on earth? Why is there suffering? What are diseases and how can we heal ourselves? What's the difference between the soul and the spirit? What's the future of our planet? Maybe if Senator McCain and Hillary Clinton and Vladimir Putin and others spent more time concentrating on these very questions, we wouldn't find ourselves once again on the brink of another war. Now to hour one. Investigative journalist Jason Leopold was originally to join us for the full 4 hours, but he's a working investigative journalist and he's got an early morning call. So we'll just have the 1 hour with him. So much to talk about with Mr. Leopold. He's got a bit of a sordid past. You may know him from Truth Out or The Public Record, or more recently from Al Jazeera America. He made his bones by breaking the Enron scandal. Remember that? The BP oil spill, government corruption, openness in government, the Plaim affair. These days, he's also reporting on Guantanamo Bay and alleged abuses there. But Jason cites his main weapon as the Freedom of Information Act, which was enacted almost 50 years ago. Some have called FOIA the most important piece of legislation in American history because it allows journalists like Jason Leopold to hold people in power accountable. But in the last number of years, corrupt government officials or incompetent or maliciously minded officials have used a loophole in FOIA that basically allows them to cover the mistakes and misdeeds with an exemption. In other words, if you screw up or you simply declare your actions a national security issue. But that's all about to change, and we'll get Jason's take on, or rather Mr. Leopold's take on, whether this might mean a real and genuine era of openness and transparency in government. One that's often been promised but never delivered. How does a journalist with a dark past learn to pry info from the government and redeem himself in the process? Investigative journalist Jason Leopold will answer that question and many more as he discusses his work covering the secret diaries of a Gitmo detainee. I'll take one more long tug on my coffee with the Oscar Wilde inscription, Work, Curse of the Drinking Class, and offer one more as we head into a break. We're all in the gutter, but some of us are looking at the stars. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast AM. Jason Leopold is an investigative reporter covering Guantanamo, counterterrorism, national security, human rights, open government, and civil liberties issues. His weapon, the Freedom of Information Act. His recent investigative reports include the worldwide exclusive, the Abu Zubaydah Diaries, based on the personal diaries of the first CIA captive who was waterboarded, a 14-month investigation involving the brother of high-value detainee Abu Zubaydah, a U.S. resident who the FBI recruited as an informant to spy on Muslims. Safety issues at BP and the Alaska Pipeline, which have been cited by CNN, 60 Minutes, the LA Times, and also led to a hearing held by the U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Transportation Subcommittee on Railroads, Pipelines, and Hazardous Materials. In 2011, Jason broke a story that went viral and was cited by CNN and dozens of domestic and international publications on how, for more than two decades, the Air Force used certain sections from the Bible to train nuclear missile launch officers on the ethics and morals of launching nuclear weapons. A day after his story was published, the Air Force removed the materials from its ethics training course. He's the author of News Junkie, a brutally honest memoir of his personal and professional life and the mistakes he's made, which spent a couple of weeks on the LA Times bestseller list. His most recent investigative report, From Hopeful Immigrant to FBI Informant, the inside story of the other Abu Zubaydah, is now available as an ebook. Jason Leopold, welcome to Coast AM. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me on.
I appreciate you spending some time with us. We don't have a lot of time with you tonight, and hopefully maybe in the future we can bring you back.
Sure, I apologize for that.
No, not at all. You're a working investigative journalist. We understand. I want to get right into your investigations into Guantanamo Bay. And we'll talk later in the hour about the diaries of one of Gitmo's most famous or infamous detainees and how that diary was obtained and what's written in those. I believe there are six volumes. But I'm guessing a lot of people, Jason, might be thinking, why should we care about what happens to the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and whether they're being forcibly fed with a feeding tube shoved down their throat? Aren't these enemy combatants? Make the argument that we should care about how these accused terrorists are being treated.
Sure. And, in fact, that is exactly what I deal with every time I publish a story about Guantanamo, which is, how do I get the public to care about this? And the problem is that for so many years now, Guantanamo, we're past the 12th year that this prison, this detention facility has been open. And what many people still do not realize is that the vast majority of prisoners in Guantanamo never stepped foot on a battlefield. After 9/11, the U.S. military, working with other governments, they basically dropped all these leaflets and offered very lucrative awards for anyone that could turn in a Guantanamo prisoner, or excuse me, someone who was affiliated with Al-Qaeda. And that essentially meant that hundreds of people were turned in by their neighbors, were accused of having ties to Al-Qaeda and other, associated forces. And so during its peak at Guantanamo, there were 779 men there. There were actually even some children there, very elderly people there. But they've never been they've never been on a battlefield. They were just, some were in the wrong place at the wrong time. Some were actually wearing the wrong wristwatch. For example, the Defense Intelligence Agency a while back put out a report by essentially saying that this certain brand of Casio watch is a known brand that's used by terrorists or Al-Qaeda to detonate bombs. So, I guess what I would say is that for the people that I've been writing about, and largely, even the ones that are accused of crimes, they have wives, they have children, they have, mothers and fathers. They're regular people. They are, unfortunately, were picked up have yet to be released, even though more than half of them are already cleared for release. The United States just does not want to admit that it made an error. And I would also, I would bring people, or I would call the attention to a very, very important declaration that was submitted in the court case of a former Guantanamo detainee. And this was a declaration that was written by Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson is the former chief of staff to former Secretary of State Colin Powell. And this was a declaration that was submitted about 3 or 4 years ago, in which Wilkerson said that he would be willing to testify in a court of law, under oath, under penalty of perjury, that the vast majority of prisoners who were in Guantanamo were innocent, were sold for bounty, never stepped foot on a battlefield, that George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld knew it, and they basically just needed to save, the there would be too much political fallout if they were to just release them. So that meant that many of them just, remain at Guantanamo, and many of them remain there to this day. So, and that's a document I have cited, in one of my stories. I've interviewed Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He says that he knows this from his own investigations during the, during the time that that he served as chief of staff to Colin Powell, and that he felt, very embarrassed and ashamed for, what this country did, is what he said, and that was the reason he came forward. So I would just, what I try to do is I try to educate people. I try to provide them with at least as much factual information as I can on Guantanamo, because when you hear Guantanamo, you think automatically, first of all, the prison. You think that everyone there deserves to be there. They're a terrorist, and they tried to kill Americans. And it's just simply not true. By the way, I've been to Guantanamo 3 times. I'm headed back next month. So, it's a very, very complicated story. It's incredibly difficult to try and get people to care. And it's not just Guantanamo. It's just the fact that, let's face it, they have Muslim names, and that stokes fear in people, and they automatically, think what they're going to think as a result of, terrorism, national security, and what have you.
And you're writing for Al Jazeera America. Do you get of people who say to you, "Well, you're obviously biased. You're sympathizing them. You're working for Al Jazeera."
Yes, I mean, I do get some of that. I also, by the way, I do contribute to The Guardian, and I also contribute to Vice News on these same topics. So sure, people will react that way. But I think that as an individual journalist, as an independent journalist, because I'm not on staff, I am an independent, that I have won the trust of my readers, who, they know that when I'm writing a story, that when I'm reporting a story on these issues, on issues of Guantanamo, for example, that I'm always, for the most part, going to have documents that go along with the story, that I'm going to have, I'm going to be interviewing people. I'm going to dig into it very hard. And they can see, some primary source material. So, there are some who will react to the platform or where it's published. And that is usually people who are just not familiar, with the type of work I do. I think that we're sort of in a time right now where the public, should start looking at, individual journalists, even if they do work for, various news organizations, and, have been able to sort of, follow those people and know what they report on. So, it's just, frankly, it's just difficult. And Al Jazeera, of course, does still have that, that stigma. But they happen to do amazing work, and it's why I contribute there, because, the editors are fantastic, and my work is treated with great respect when I'm submitting.
There have been a number of hunger strikes, obviously, at Guantanamo Bay, detainees attempting to go on hunger strikes, and they have, in some instances, or most instances, been forcibly fed, force feeding.
Yes.
And there is a Syrian national, a detainee, and his attorneys with the human rights charity Reprieve have been waging a lengthy legal battle over Guantanamo's force-feeding practices. First of all, explain what's involved in these force-feeding practices.
Sure.
And then what the crux of the Syrian nationals case is.
Sure. Well, last year, I actually, when I was writing for Al Jazeera English, which is the Doha-based news organization before Al Jazeera America was launched, I obtained a very, very important document related to Guantanamo.
Let me just jump in here, Jason. I apologize. The music's percolating up here. We'll continue this conversation on the other side. We'll get into the force-feeding practices, some say the abuses, taking place at Gitmo. Jason Leopold is with us, investigative journalist. My name is Richard Serrett. You're listening to Coast to Coast. Welcome back. Let me crib here from one of Jason Leopold's recent articles for Al Jazeera America entitled Gitmo Brass Testifying on Force Feeding Would Be Bad for Morale, U.S. says. The former warden of the Guantanamo Bay detention facility should not be hauled into court to defend against our enemy's legal challenges because it could lead to low morale among soldiers under his command who may question his leadership skills, the Justice Department argued in court documents. Moreover, the government's court paper states the senior medical officer at Guantanamo should not have to sacrifice his well-earned military leave to testify about a hunger-striking detainee's medical needs and the detention facility's force-feeding practices. Quote, it would be fantastic to suggest that alien enemies could haul our military leaders into judicial tribunals to account for their day-to-day activities on the battlefront, end quote. The government's court filing states, citing a case from 1950 to justify its arguments. The government made those arguments earlier in July in response to a motion filed last month by attorneys representing a hunger-striking Guantanamo prisoner who is challenging the legality of his force-feeding and asked the federal court judge to compel the testimony of three high-ranking Guantanamo officials the attorneys allege are responsible for implementing the controversial protocols. Syrian national Abu Wael Diab has been cleared for release or transfer since 2009. His attorneys with the human rights charity Reprieve have been waging a lengthy legal battle over Guantanamo's force-feeding practices as part of a broader challenge over Diab's 12-year imprisonment. We'll find out when we return here on Coast why we should care. More of my conversation with investigative reporter Jason Leopold. On the other side, when Coast to Coast continues, stay with us. My name is Richard Serrett. Jason Leopold is with us, investigative reporter. And we're talking about a number of things, including his coverage of the detainees at Gitmo. And I was cribbing from a recent article, Jason, about this court case, the detainee in question here, a Syrian national, has been force-fed. How does that work exactly? They're hauled out of their cell and strapped into a chair. Tell me more about that process.
Sure. And as I was, before the break, as I was saying, the a very important document that I obtained last year, last May, I reported this for Al Jazeera English, and this was basically it was the standard operating procedures about how the force feeding and the hunger strike is managed by Guantanamo officials. This was a document that was completely unredacted. Nothing like it has ever before been published. And it says that, hunger striking Guantanamo prisoners, they're force fed a liquid nutritional supplement. They do undergo very brutal and dehumanizing medical procedure. They wear masks over their mouths while they sit shackled in a restraint chair for as long as 2 hours. At the end of the feeding, they're removed from the restraint chair and placed into what's called a dry cell with no running water. And then a guard observes them for about 45 to 60 minutes for any indications of vomiting or attempts to induce, vomiting of this liquid nutritional supplement, which is Ensure or something similar to that. And if the detainee does vomit, they're placed back in the restraint chair. So the way that this was managed is that, if they missed several consecutive meals, They would be monitored. If their weight was went down a certain level, they would be asked to drink voluntarily a nutritional supplement. If they refused, they're forcibly removed from their cell, put in a restraint chair, head, arms, legs, you know, strapped in, and a tube is shoved up their nose, threaded down to their stomach. They do a little X-ray on the chest to make sure it hit the stomach, and they do that by, you know, putting a little water in there at first just to make sure it has. And then the you know, the process could take 2 hours. It could take a half an hour. There have been some prisoners at Guantanamo who have been force-fed for 7 years now, who just refuse to eat. This is the you know, the way that they protest their confinement.
And I would imagine that having a tube shoved down your throat or down your nose and snake down into your stomach would be, I think they call it a nasogastric tube. That would be uncomfortable, but would that constitute torture in your mind?
Well, you have to think about it this way. So, you know, the force feeding does happen, obviously, I wouldn't call it force feeding. When someone goes to a hospital and they're unable to eat, you know, a doctor is there and they're, you know, assisting them with, you know, with this way to make sure they get, you know, nutrients into their body. Here at Guantanamo, this is a form of protest. You know, these prisoners are protesting their confinement, their indefinite detention, the fact that they've been held without charge for more than a decade. So the manner in which it is conducted in the way in which they are subjected to this type of feeding does rise to the level of torture, according to human rights organizations. You know, the UN has called it torture. The World Medical Association, the American Medical Association has stopped short of calling it torture, but basically said it's, you know, it's completely dehumanizing. So, you know, what you read during the break was the context of that also is that, you know, there are videos that were shot of these prisoners being force-fed. So there are news organizations trying to obtain these. I have a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit against the Department of Defense to try to obtain these videos. If this isn't torture, let the government at least provide these videos to show us how it's not, you know, how it would be conducted.
And the detainee at the center of this one particular case, the Syrian national Abu Wail Diab, I understand he is an individual in a wheelchair. Tell me more about that.
Yes. He's, you know, his health is not well. His wheelchair was actually apparently taken away from him because he would not voluntarily submit to, you know, the demands of the military. They call him non-compliant. He's not being compliant. And as a result, they, you know, removed his wheelchair. He can't walk or has difficulty walking, at least. I mean, his attorneys have more or less said that he's incapable of walking. And they, you know, as punishment that they're alleging, they took away his wheelchair because of the protest that he is waging against his confinement, against the procedures that take place to force feed him and other prisoners. And that's what this lawsuit is basically about, is, you know, the hunger strike, the force feeding protocols, they change regularly. I just wrote a story 3 days ago. I wrote this for Vice News, and this is about this particular case. The hunger strike protocol previously said that detainees could have a choice of a lubricant. Okay, when they're you know, putting this tube, this nasogastric tube, up their nose, so they would have a choice of a lubricant to sort of make it a little bit more comfortable for them. One of the popular choices was olive oil, and olive oil would be placed on the tube, and then it would be threaded through their nose and into their stomach. Well, they just changed the protocol for that. And you want to know why? Because they figured out that And they figured out that olive oil, which they've been using for many, many, many years, causes a serious form of pneumonia called lipoid pneumonia. And, you know, I mention this because, one, the military officials often state that, you know, these prisoners get exemplary medical care, the best medical care, that the nurses that are performing these procedures, you know, are professionals. And here we have, you know, something like simple as olive oil that is not a water-based lubricant that could actually, you know, the fatty part of the olive oil gets into their lungs and could cause a serious form of pneumonia. And they have been using this for years. They only stopped because a renowned doctor had submitted a declaration in this case and said, essentially, this is medical malpractice. This is negligence. How on earth could you be using this? So, you know, in the big picture of all of this, I mean, again, this goes to show, or this is what I'm trying to demonstrate, of how difficult Guantanamo is and how important it is to really cover and write about these, you know, sort of side stories. You know, that was a huge challenge for me, by the way. How do I put together a story about olive oil and try to make it sort of appealing to people, and at least at the same time get them to understand what's happening here?
Let's talk about Gitmo's first high-value prisoner, Abu Zubaydah. This was also the first prisoner, from what I understand, to undergo what was then called enhanced interrogation techniques, but has since been legally characterized as torture. Now, Abu Zubaydah apparently wrote a diary, about six volumes, and how did Al Jazeera America come into possession of those diaries, and what was contained in them?
Yeah, and let me just also mention that Abu Zubaydah is the one who the torture memo, that infamous memo that John Yoo wrote, which is commonly referred to as the torture memo, was written specifically for him. His name is in it, and that's who it was written for. I have been after these diaries for 10 years. I've been trying. I traveled all over to try to see if I could obtain these diaries. And I filed Freedom of Information Act requests. I was close to filing a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit until last summer. I had received an email from a source who basically provided me with some information to say that these diaries are ready for me. You know, it was a source who essentially provided me with the documents. So this is one of the very few documents, which is sort of interesting, that I have not obtained through the Freedom of Information Act. These documents, these six volumes of diaries were leaked to me. And they are the most fascinating documents to come out since, you know, 9/11, as far as I'm concerned.
We should point out to Jason that Zubaydah, the claim is that he helped manage a training camp in Afghanistan for Al-Qaeda.
There are numerous claims about Zubaydah and numerous claims about who he is, who he was, what he did. And the vast majority of those claims are just simply not true. The U.S. government said that Abu Zubaydah was one of the planners of 9/11. They said that he was involved in the planning of every major terrorist attack, you know, going back to the 90s. He absolutely was not. They actually even said, you know, some former FBI agents said he was schizophrenic. He was not. He's actually a pretty brilliant guy. And these diaries are incredibly fascinating. They're fascinating for several reasons. One, it shows how a young man who grew up in a upper middle class family in Saudi Arabia how he went from computer engineering student in India to student of jihad. He is his writing is just so detailed in terms of what he talks about, how you get to see this, his own transformation, what it was about, what he was railing against, what his hopes, his fears were. This is a man who talked about George Michael, the singer, Chris de Burgh, the singer, two of his favorite singers. He talked about Bollywood and, you know, would quote famous writers. And the portrait that emerges is not of a hardened terrorist. It's of, sadly for him, it's just of a man who had these, you know, these dreams that that were never realized. That he ended up in Afghanistan and he embraced the, you know, jihadist life. You know, we are there at the birth of Al Qaeda because he writes about it. We're there at the rise of the Taliban. We hear, you know, right after 9/11, as the U.S. invades Afghanistan, from the perspective of him, he's writing about what's happening. He's writing about the U.S. invasion, and I mean, it's nothing that anyone has ever read before, because there's simply no document like this out there—a first-person account from one of the, you know, most notorious, high-value prisoners, accused terrorists that the U.S. has captured. He was the first high-value prisoner captured after 9/11.
And so, it was during his enhanced interrogation technique, or his torture, that Zubaydah supposedly revealed that it was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed who was the mastermind behind the 9/11 attacks.
Yes, that's it. That's what, how the story goes. And I looked through I read his diaries many times, because each time you just learn something new. I did not see anything about that in there, but it's very clear that as the years went by, certainly after 9/11, that or right after 9/11, that, you know, he was someone that was deemed to be very important, and that he aligned himself with Al Qaeda simply because, you know, he had his own sort of aspirations in terms of, you know, plans that were never realized. But, you know, keep in mind that the U.S. made him out to be this ultimate boogeyman, and he never was. And why did they do that? I mean, there are so many unanswered questions, but, you know, they wanted to, you know, torture him. And during the paperwork that went back and forth between the CIA, the Justice Department, and other agencies, they made these, you know, wild claims about him. And it just was not true. And, you know, I mean, look, we're seeing right now what's happening around the world with, people are asking, why are young people going to fight in Syria, in Libya? I mean, reading this man's diaries would probably be the best sort of education that someone could get on these issues. Because you get to, as I indicated, you get to this first-person account that nobody has ever, had the opportunity to see before. It's not like there's a bunch of diaries out there.
Does Abu Zubaydah come across in your mind as in any way, the remotest way, a sympathetic character?
Oh, no doubt. Absolutely. I mean, I wrote five very, very lengthy stories, a five-part series that I put together. And he's very sympathetic. In fact, you know, the first volume is sympathetic. He comes across as an incredibly sympathetic character. And this is a guy who continuously talked about, you know, being married, starting a family. He was traumatized by what he witnessed his father doing to his mother as a young man. I mean, he suffered probably from some severe psychological damage as far as his upbringing was concerned. I mean, he was of Palestinian descent, so he lived in Saudi Arabia, and he did not have any he did not have citizenship. He was sort of stateless, and unlike some of his peers, he couldn't go to college in Saudi Arabia because he was not a citizen.
So, Jason, we're just about at it. We're just about out of time here, and if the opportunity arises, I would love to have you back on to talk more about his diaries, but I really appreciate you spending some time with us. Jason Leopold, thank you.
I appreciate it, and I apologize again for the short time that we had today.
Not at all. When we come back, an introduction to subconscious ethereal science and past life regression therapy. Coast to Coast AM continues after this. My name is Richard Serrett. Stay a while.